I'd like to introduce Neil for, hopefully not the last time, but the last time here, for this time, so. That's Neil's, in case you can't find him, I'm gonna hand him a second chair.
I'm gonna start off today, much like yesterday. I do a lot of substitute teaching, particularly long-term substitute teaching. I happen to be teaching a class in junior language arts. And I was teaching from a lesson plan, and I was really bored by the lesson plan, as were the students. So we had an impromptu discussion about what is it like to be young? And we talked about that for 4 or 5 minutes, and then I told them, you know, I'd really like to know what you think processing the idea of being young. What is it like? So I gave them a writing assignment, and they turned it back on me. And they said, what is it like to get old? So in response, this is what they got.
Is he Mike?
Oh, Mike?
Yeah.
I have it on. Well, it's a step above yesterday.
I know, you're improving.
If I'm here for a year, I might have it all together.
Skim pick, say hello to your weekend plan.
Thank you. Poet. No, I'm not going to do it now. I was going to try and get rid of those little pop-ups.
Oh, well, they're not here yet.
You don't have a slide.
As I've aged, I've become kinder to myself and less critical of myself. I've become my own friend. I have seen too many dear friends leave this world too soon before they understood the great freedom that comes with aging. Whose business is it if I choose to read or play on the computer until 4 a.m. or sleep until noon? I will dance with myself to those wonderful tunes of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and if I, at the same time, wish to weep over a loss, I will. I will walk the beach in a swimsuit that is stretched over a bulging body. Will dive into the waves with abandon if I choose to, despite the pitying glances from the jet set. They too will get old. I know I'm sometimes forgetful, but there again, some of life is just as well forgotten. And I eventually remember the important things. Sure, over the years, my heart has been broken. How can your heart not break when you lose a loved one, or when a child suffers, or even when somebody's beloved pet gets hit by a car? But broken hearts are what give us strength and understanding and compassion. A heart never broken is pristine and sterile, and will never know its joy, the joy of being imperfect. I am so blessed that I have lived long enough to have my hair turning gray and to have my youthful laughs be forever etched in the deep grooves of my face. So many have never laughed, and so many have died before their hair could turn gray. As you get older, it is easier to be positive. You care less about what other people think. I don't question myself anymore. I've even earned the right to be wrong. So to answer your question, I like being old. It has set me free. I like the person I have become. I am not going to live forever, and while I am still here, I will not waste time lamenting what could have been or worrying about what will be. And I shall eat dessert every single day. And I added this today. May the friendships made here never come apart. When all I have shared with you comes straight from my heart. And I have to say that now because at the end I probably wouldn't be able to. That's that.
Thank you.
Yesterday, we...
Can you get the light to go on you?
Leave these lights on because I need to do some reading. Whether you knew it or not, and if you didn't know it, you weren't paying attention. Yesterday I was about as dysfunctional as I have been in a long time. Was it Swift that said a little learning is a dangerous thing? A little learning is a dangerous thing. Tasty. It's fine, I'm old, I can yesterday I felt totally dysfunctional. There was so much going through my head that I skipped major parts of historical trauma. So I have summarized yesterday to help us understand a little bit better what I want to talk about. Oh, so my glasses make that foggy. What I want to talk about today. So this is just kind of a reminder with regard to what I blathered through yesterday. It is estimated that 90 to 95% of the indigenous population died within two generations of contact in 1492. The population of the Caribbean area affected was between 8 and 10 million prior to colonization in 1492. By 1518, the population is estimated to have been 28,000, and by 1550, essentially all of the indigenous population of Hispaniola was gone. 90 to 120 million Aboriginal people in the Americas in 1492 and following colonization, original population levels and cultural integrity have never been restored to any of the many tribes and cultures impacted by the arrival of the Spaniards and other Europeans that followed. Epidemics continue to ravage Aboriginal populations through the influenza epidemic of 1918. And I talked about the fact that the Black Plague, etc., hit Europe in long cycles. There's a long time between each plague, so they could recover. Where our indigenous people suffered the ravages of plagues and disease every 7 to 11 years. So their culture could never be brought back. The primary depopulation influences were diseases in successive waves, principally smallpox, influenza, measles, plus typhoid, dysentery, yellow fever, syphilis, in addition to colonization, slavery, proselytization, famine, starvation, and associated violence. That combined with the virgin soil susceptibility to disease pathogens completely destroyed social structures, and intentional, ineffective medical treatment of indigenous people did not allow them to survive. There is no single historic trauma response. Rather, there are different social disorders that represent clusters of symptoms. Hidden collective memories of this trauma or collective non-remembering is passed from generation to generation, as are the maladaptive social and behavioral patterns that are symptoms of many social disorders called historic trauma. In short, historic trauma causes deep breakdown in social functioning that may last for many years, decades, and even generations. When trauma is ignored and there is no support for dealing with it, the trauma is passed from one generation to the next. What we learn and see as normal when we are children, we pass on to our own children. Children who learn that physical and sexual abuse is normal and who have never dealt with the feelings that come from this may inflict physical, mental, and sexual abuse on their own children. The unhealthy ways of behaving that people use to protect themselves can be passed on without them even knowing they are doing so. For the past 500 years, what happened 500 years ago for us?
Luther.
The 95 Theses. Luther. We're talking about Columbus. In the past 500 years, the entire indigenous population have been traumatized by multiple deaths from disease, warfare, expulsion from their homelands, loss of economic and self-sufficiency, removal of children from their homes, boarding school, assimilation tactics, and incarceration in residential schools. Compound this with the loss of ceremonial freedom, dance, song, and other methods that would have helped Aboriginal people express their grief and their losses. So to some extent, I hope that pulls together the way I put things yesterday. We are now at the point of talking about forced relocation and the termination period. There was a movement, there was an act called the Termination Act, where they were going to terminate reservations, period. The first reservation terminated was the Menominee Reservation in Minnesota. The Menominees on the reservation were actually a very successful Native population. They had problems, but they were probably surviving better than a lot of other Native populations on reservations. And the government, in all its wisdom, terminated their reservation, and in approximately 5 to 7 years, they became one of the most destitute areas in the United States. The complete disintegration of anything government was lost. They gave you X number of dollars and said, okay, we're done now. It's your choice to survive or not. And unfortunately, the Menominee didn't. During the forced relocation and termination period, there was a prohibition on religious freedom. They could not practice the normal religious, symbolic religious practices that pulled the people together, that held them together, that made them a people separate from the Catholics and the Lutherans. It's not that they didn't believe in God, they just believed in God in a different way. And they practiced their own religious beliefs. That was lost. Where racism was evident, it's during this forced relocation and termination period that racism became rampant. And that's primarily because of relocation. Removing natives from a reservation area, from an area that they had become accustomed to, or as the Blackfeet, were fortunate enough to be relocated on their native lands. These relocated indigenous people were forced to move into larger cities, Seattle, Portland, and those two in particular, in my mind, because of friends who moved there, and found overt racism. And I'm going to challenge you as individuals to stand at the checking counter in a Walmart store or a Sam's Club or a Costco if you live near a reservation. I have purposely spent time watching what happens when natives come through with their basket and they get their groceries and they leave, and the conversations that go on between clerks after they leave, talking about those damn Indians. Why do those prairie niggers have to come in here? That's in Montana. It's rampant. We don't necessarily see it because we don't think of ourselves as being racist. I have worked on all 7 reservations. I've spent months, years, 12 years working with Native populations. And the stories I hear, particularly from kids, sometimes it's stories at a reservation school about how they were treated. And we have these discussions so that these kids can open up and we can talk about it. But it's really interesting for me to also go to a lot of non-Native schools and get into discussions about, and these are schools that are contiguous to reservations. And hear how overtly racist they are. And again, my point of focus is in Montana. But I know it goes on in all those areas contiguous to reservations. In Shoto, where I grew up, where I was principal, and where I still work off and on, we've had some very, very, what word do I want? Beyond honest discussions with the students about racism in our school. We're a small school, 180 kids. We have 13 Native Americans. We have 2 African Americans. We have 1 Samoan that nobody argues with. Because he's bigger than anybody else. And the kids didn't realize that they were racist. Some of the things they were saying, calling a kid a prairie nigger, they didn't see that as racist. Excluding some Native American kids from activities, not intentionally, not overtly, but just by ignoring them, making them feel unwelcome. And over the years, we've addressed that, and it's become much less common. But there's a school north of Shoto, right next to the reservation, that is now 52% Native American. And yet it's not on the reservation. And the level of racism there, both against Native Americans and against whites, is just unreal. It's hard to imagine that kids can be like this. But then you talk to the adults, and they're worse. Mm-hmm. Along with forced relocation and termination, there's a loss of governmental systems. And governmental systems on reservations in Montana are the most incredibly messed up governmental systems I think you could ever run into. With an example is the city of Browning filed for bankruptcy, and the city of Browning is now being taken over by the tribal council. The corruption, the level of corruption in tribal councils is rampant. You read about it constantly in the newspaper. An example that I can give you that I can document is the building of Twin Blackbones Campground along Lower St. Mary Lake, just south of Babb. It's a project that started in 1962, was finally completed last year. The initial cost, the initial bundle of money that the government threw at it, was $8 million. Out of that $8 million, not even a survey was made. But quite a number of tribal council members moved to Arizona and New Mexico, and that $8 million disappeared. More money was invested in Chewing Black Bones. A survey was done, there was a little bit of digging, and X number of millions of dollars again disappeared. Finally, the last infusion of money was about $4 million, and the campground now exists because the tribal council was really held accountable. $16 million. It should have been a glorious campground. And with termination came loss of community. Native Americans tend to be very social. They're very tight community-wise, even though among the Blackfeet, there's the Badger Clan, the Bear Clan, the Wolf Clan, etc., who are all independent clan-wise. They are still very solid in the three tribes within the Blackfeet Nation, the Pikuni, the Sitsika, and the Blood. That was lost. Fortunately, in 1957, the Termination Act was taken off the books. And not that many reservations were severely affected because things happen on Indian time. And if you don't know what Indian time is, if you're there before it's over, you're on time. Nothing starts on time, nothing ends on time. And I've learned to live with that. I actually think it's quite wonderful. It's just the way it is. Yes.
When was that act enacted?
1951 or 52. I have it in my notes. I should have looked it up. The glorious thing is that it was seen as being incredibly harmful. Something that I didn't mention yesterday, and I should have mentioned today. I remember the doctrine of discovery in 1453, Pope Alexander VI said that any land discovered by the Spaniards, etc., that was not Christianized could be taken and dealt with in any size, shape, or form. And that expanded to England, France, etc., etc. In 1823, the U.S. Supreme Court accepted the doctrine of discovery. 1823. That gave the settlers the fur traders, whomever, the right to just take land. It's still on the books. And it makes me furious that that's still used as an excuse to take land from Native Americans. 2,400 acres were taken from the Apache. This is mineral-rich soil land, and it was exchanged for 3,400 acres of substandard, worthless land. The first time this was offered to Congress, they rejected it. So John McCain attached it as a rider to a national defense bill. Well, you can't take just part of a bill and pass it. You pass the whole thing or you don't pass it at all. Consequently, that land now belongs to Tinto. For those of you who are familiar with our discussion yesterday, Tinto was involved, that is involved here. That's not the only land that's been taken. And it's under, they don't say it comes under the doctrine of discovery, but that's the underlying cause, because the doctrine of discovery is still on the books. I'm just rambling. So this is what we've been talking about, historical trauma. Historical trauma causes deep breakdowns in social functioning that may last for many years, decades, or generations. Clusters of symptoms may be passed to the next generation in the form of socially learned behavior patterns. And to historical trauma, there is a response, the sense that you cannot grieve, that no one hears or is listening to your grief. The dominant culture acts as if you do not have grief or do not have to grieve. The sense that you cannot grieve. All of us have gone through grief, and we will continue to go through grief, and we grieve. And there's a process of grieving and getting over that grief, hopefully. And it's the documented stages that grief comes in. No one hears or is listening to your grief. If nobody listens, then you're talking to yourself. You can't get over grief talking to yourself. So what do? You quit talking. And the dominant culture That's us. Acts as if you do not have grief, or do not have to grieve. Historical trauma transmission, HTT, and I'll discuss the difference between PTSD and traumatic transmission in a minute. How is historical trauma transmitted? Abuse, spousal, child, sexual, addiction, alcohol, drugs, gambling, depression, loss of parenting skills, learned helplessness, loss of sense of family and interdependence, guilt, perceived external locus of control, and suicidal. The traumatic memories are passed to the next generation through different channels, including biological, and it's been pretty much proven that there is a hereditary predisposition. Cultural, through storytelling. Social, inadequate parenting, violence, abuse, and psychological, memory processes and channels. I told you before when I first started on Monday that I suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. And told you that, like alcoholism, once you have it, you've always got it. But you can overcome, and I have, in my own way, overcome my PTSD. I just know that I have it. PTSD is associated generally with a single event. For me, PTSD came about because of the Vietnam War, spending 2.5 years as a combat medic and seeing things that I cannot describe to you. But it was a single event. It just lasted 2.5 years. Historical trauma has lasted 500 years. And it continues. It's a melding of multiple offenses. Where with PTSD, I can point to when I went through therapy, hypnotherapy, I was taken back to specific combat situations where I could actually hear, feel, smell, taste, everything that was going on, and I could be made to let go. With historical trauma, there are so many factors that have been around for so long, they are not lost. Chronic suicidal ideation. On the Standing Rock Reservation, 2 years ago, which is the latest data that I have, in 3 months, there were 11 suicides in children between 12 and 15 years old. In 4 months, there were 291 cases of planned suicide. Montana has the highest rate of suicide in the nation. Suicide among Native Americans is 2 times the national average. This is real. I had one of the most marvelous, and I think she would have been the premier cross-country runner that Montana has ever had. Her name was Lynn Keenan. As a sophomore, she ran a state record at the state championships. As a junior, she broke that record. In the summer between her junior and senior years, she committed suicide. We found out that she had been sexually abused by her three brothers for over 10 years. Further examples of what historic trauma response is: explosive and extremely inhibited anger, and they may alternate. It may not just be inhibited all the time or explosive all the time. It can be so back and forth that you never know from one day to the next how a parent or a brother or a friend is going to act. Compulsive or extremely inhibited sexuality. It may alternate. Amnesia for traumatic events. It's amazing how historical trauma can create a mind that you are physically abused or sexually abused. And after the act, you can forget it and just let it go. And yet that's a symptom of historical trauma transmission. Transient dissociative episodes, they come and go. Reliving experiences, suddenly in a classroom, having a student relive vividly having been abused or watching a friend commit suicide. These are all real circumstances. These are things that I have seen. A sense of helplessness or paralysis of initiative. Helplessness, hopelessness. Helplessness, hopelessness. When you feel helpless, you feel hopeless. Shame, guilt, self-blame. Utter aloneness. That I am the only person that feels this. Unrealistic attribution of total power to the perpetrator. There are so many of my native friends who have gone through and come beyond this, attributing all of the power to the government. To the white people surrounding, the non-indigenous people surrounding the reservation. And you just surrender to them. And thank you, God, for bringing us to the point where many of our indigenous people are getting beyond that. Isolation and withdrawal goes along with utter aloneness, persistent distrust. I have worked on two reservations in Montana where it took me a full 3 years to gain any degree of trust. And this is working with them to bring about a better existence in their mind, not my mind, trying to bring about what they needed, what they wanted, what they thought was best for them. Doing everything that I could to help. And I'm going back to one of those reservations, reservation schools. I'm going back to Heart Butte this, well, as soon as I get, as I leave here. And that's one of the areas where I now have a degree of trust. But every time I go back, I have to re-earn it. I have to prove that I'm worthy of being trusted. Where with a normal Caucasian school, I can earn a degree of trust in the day. I sit down with the staff and tell them what I want to do and how we're going to do it, and they say, okay, let's go. It's not that way with Native populations, and it shouldn't be. We haven't earned their trust. And a sense of hopelessness and despair. All of these exist on every reservation to some degree or another. The Salish Kootenai Reservation near Kalispell has probably done the most amazing work in working with the population and getting past historical trauma. It's still there, but it's where in most of the populations I work with, it's like this. It's now on the Salish Kootenai pulling away, and they're becoming independent. That's a marvelous, marvelous thing to see. So I want you all to just close your eyes while I read this to you, and I want you to get a sense of what John Fire Lame Deer is saying. Before our white brothers arrived to make us civilized men, we didn't have any kind of prison. Because of this, we had no delinquents. Without a prison, there can be no delinquents. We had no locks nor keys, and therefore among us there were no thieves. When someone was so poor that he couldn't afford a horse, a tent, or a blanket, he would, in that case, receive it all as a gift. We were too uncivilized to give great importance to private property. We didn't know any kind of money, and consequently, the value of a human being was not determined by his wealth. We had no written laws laid down, no lawyers, no politicians. Therefore, we were not able to cheat and swindle one another. We were really in bad shape before the white man arrived, and I don't know how to explain how we were able to manage without these fundamental things that, as they tell us, are so necessary for a civilized society. Normally this presentation is a full day and then an evening of discussion. That's why it's been so difficult for me to pull it together into a couple of hours. But what do you think? Most of you are from Montana. Most of you are familiar with reservations. Most of you have had associations with Native American people.
One thing I think is that the Native Americans lived on the land. The population densities that allowed the lifestyle like he had. Our population densities now are so great, his lifestyle can't work with that. The seems that these problems that we're talking about is because there are too darn many of us for us to be able to go back to that rather open style that our Native Americans had. That's the first thing that hit me.
Anybody respond to that?
No, I'm not, no offense, I'm not convinced of that. I've read a lot of books about the clash of the white man moving west. And to me, it comes back, they had land, and they clearly had identifying boundaries that were somewhat fluid. Be it in the east, the Shawnee, the Iroquois, the Choctaw, they may have fluid. But all that land was wanted by the white person. And to me, it's just this progression west. So I'm not convinced about that part of it. I think there were opportunities. The other thing I want to say really quickly, as you closed, is I did a bicycle tour in North Dakota many times. And once going across the bridge in Newtown, busy bridge, a lot of RVs, and the most dangerous people to bicycle drivers in my time were RV drivers, seriously. And a Native American, two in a pickup truck, got behind me. And we went across that bridge at 7 miles an hour, and they protected me. And the next time it happened was Bismarck on 5 o'clock or 4:30 on a Friday afternoon. And they routed us by the Capitol, which is incredibly stupid, and I was sick and I was riding a recumbent. And I went up this long climb, about 2.5 miles, and one of the people went by me and says, "Well, how can you go that slow without tipping over?" And it's a gift. And again, I was sick. And three in this beat up old pickup truck got behind me somewhat at the very beginning, and we went all the way across the interstate to my hotel. And they protected me the whole way, and I have never forgotten that. And I think that has more to do with their culture than any other thing that I personally have ever experienced.
I can add to that. I live in a predominantly white community, and have worked on Blackfeet Reservation for a long time, and all the other reservations for a lesser time. And my sense is that if I am in need, my first choice will be my friends on the Blackfeet Reservation, because I know without question they will be there in a heartbeat. They drive down from Browning to Great Falls where people get groceries. Two or three times a week, they'll have family stop to make a pit stop. Have a cup of coffee. It's always for a cup of coffee. It's never just to stop and have a pit stop and leave. You always have to have a conversation. And then they're on their way. But I've always sensed, and I've never passed, but I've always sensed that they are such a caring, take care of population across the board. I don't care if you're talking about Blackfeet or Choctaw or Osage or whatever. That sense of a need to care for is just a part of their culture. Thank you.
What are the Kootenai and Salish doing to work through this problem that you mentioned?
Well, one of the great advantages they have is they are surrounded by, they're on the west side of the mountains. So there's a lot more industry, so there are a lot more jobs, there's a lot more money available. They were the first ones to build a community college, which is a very, very good school. Their nursing program is second to none in the state. I don't care what the heck Bozeman says, or Haver, or anybody else. They have a nursing program that is phenomenal. And it's pride in that, and a degree of leadership that we haven't seen on a lot of other reservations. The level of education among the Salish Kootenai is way higher on the average. They have far more college graduates than any of the other reservations do. And if we get into education, I can talk for hours and hours about that.
Do those well-educated Native Americans go back to the reservation for the most part?
The Salish Kootenai certainly do. There's a big push now and financial support from the Gates Foundation and a couple other foundations to provide scholarship money for deserving Native American students, but they have to agree to come back to the reservation. Once they graduate, they have X number of years to improve their skills, to prove themselves, but then they have to come back to the reservation. And thus far it's been pretty darn good.
That's wonderful.
I don't know if you ever saw it. It was a NOVA program. It's probably 30 years old, but it's called The Long Walk. It was the story of a Navajo man who had his PhD and worked in Los Alamos labs as a nuclear physicist, and showed his life there, and then his walk back, which means his BMW, and then his pickup, and then walking back to his home for the weekend. And it's always haunted me that he did not fit in either place.
Yeah.
And I think the problem with education, there's lots of glory about education, but the problem with it is you're almost disconnected from your community. And any comments on that?
And that, with the exception of the Salish Kootenai, is probably very, very true. It's less true on the Blackfeet Reservation because the education there has improved markedly. When you get to Rocky Boy, Fort Belknap, Northern Cheyenne, Crow, they definitely are really hurting educationally. They're the toughest schools to break into and improve the product that they're putting out. Consequently, their chances of surviving in college is diminished. And truthfully, for me, the greatest problem is getting kids to leave the reservation and be comfortable in the dominant population. And Missoula has done, I think, the best job of assimilating, because they had the first Native American Studies program. They have a brand new, I don't know what they call it, it's a building devoted to Native American, where they can get specific counseling and so on.
Coming from Minnesota, you know, I think that the ELCA apology from
Minnesota
is impactful. We have Native communities in Minneapolis, some schools that are predominantly Native, intentionally. But I think it's one thing to apologize. I think another thing, coming from white privilege, we need to listen. They need to tell us, people need to tell us what they need, and it may not mean what we want to hear. But if we really are in penance, we need to hear that and do it. in Minneapolis, if a Native or African-American kid is picked up with a joint, they're sent to juvenile detention center, which is the PAT. If a white kid is caught, they're sent to our chemical dependency treatment center. So I see a lot of Native kids going back to the reservation. And they're scared in Minneapolis. They're scared.
To take off on just something that you said very briefly, they need to tell us what they need. Mm-hmm. What we have to do is quit telling them what they need and then listen and facilitate. Mm-hmm. Not give it to them, but facilitate their acquiring. Because for too long, we have given to them and they haven't learned the means
and
to acquire.
Resentful. See, we try.
Well, I was just going to say for Big Sky people here, sometimes I feel, a lot of times I feel that Big Sky has turned its back on the rest of Montana. You know, where we are is southwest. You know, we're south of Bozeman, which is doing pretty well economically. You don't see urban Indians who are homeless like you would in Billings or even Missoula, I think. And we think, I don't think we understand the rest of Montana, even though we're really proud of being Montanans. And so what should we do?
Well, that really is the crux of the problem. The people who live contiguous to reservations know the problem and are undoubtedly the most racist of people who live in Montana.
Anyway, it's a huge...
I would just... what we need to do is look at it as a condition that exists in Montana. And places like Big Sky that don't have the awareness need to be made aware.
We have, in the Synod, we have Our Savior's Lutheran and Rocky Boy.
Yeah.
I mean, should we learn more about that?
We just had a big meeting at Our Savior's, and Linda Webster, who is a marvelous person, has a really tough road, because on the average, I've been to church there three times, and I think the most people that were there was like six or seven. So that's tough, and it's tough to go up, and I don't take this wrong, to go up against the Catholic Church. I've been trying, because I know Harry Barnes, who was the chairman of the tribal council in Browning, and I've been trying to talk him into letting Jessica come and give the apology. The problem is Father Ed, who is the Catholic priest, is fearful that the Lutheran Church is trying to wheedle their way into the Catholic population he has. And 90% of the people who go to church are Catholic. You can go to Little Flower Parish and he will have two services and there will be 150 to 200 people at every service. You go to a funeral and you can have 500 people. We just don't talk about the problem if it's not in our face. And until we accept the fact that as a state we are racist when it comes particularly to Native Americans. I think African Americans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, have a far better place in this state than do Native Americans.
Do the Catholics realize that this is a problem? Do they have someone like
you as an advocate for the Native American within there, or is it just keep going the way it is because it's okay?
Father Ed had me come in and do a discussion on historical trauma. The school had me do it with the teachers so that they can understand the kids and their reactions better. But accepting it in any other way, I don't think so. He's very protective of his fiefdom. And I'm not talking out of turn, I keep telling him that too. You know, I'm not trying to intrude on your fiefdom, Father Ed, but dang.
I'll just talk a little bit about Rocky Boy. They're part of the Senate I belong to. Mm-hmm. I know Pastor Webster quite well. I know last year we had a cluster meeting. She broke down in tears because her financing just wasn't there.
Oh, it's this horrible.
And she works endlessly to get grants from back east, a lot of churches from Pennsylvania, from all over the country do help, but it's such a struggle for her. And the Senate does give a small amount. I mean, I'm not trying to...
It is a small amount.
It is.
I'm on the Senate. So.
And you're right, it's just such a struggle for her. And that church has been there for about 80 years, so it's a long-standing church. It hasn't always been ELCA, of course, but it was one of the earlier churches on the reservation that was not Catholic. But you're right, there is a mission there, too. But it's just a very struggle. And she's done wonderful things. She shared some of the help that through the church for women that have had problems.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you know, Pastor.
Yeah, she's a marvelous lady. Last question.
Comment. Another question, just a quick comment. Too quick. I read a lot. I'm not the smartest French writer in Happy Meal, so I read a lot of historical fiction. You could read the nonfiction. I just like it in my historical. And there are some great historical fiction authors out there. James Fromm, whose wife is Shawnee, he's a historian. Michael and I think it's Linda Geer have written a huge series. And a true historian would agree with it, but probably prefer the fiction, nonfiction. But they bring these cultures to life. The thing I keep thinking about as you talk is, think about giving the historical trauma. Most of us, unless you read this kind of stuff, don't realize they had really amazing, flourishing societies, cultures. Not perfect. They had war and all that kind of stuff. It wasn't perfect. But, you know, there's a series on the Chokoa, Choka by St. Louis. It's huge Indian mounds that we've totally ignored. Anyway, anybody interested in the kind of books that I've read that I really felt helpful? And I just wanted to say thank you, Neil, for sharing all this. I mean, I think this is, you should be doing this every day someplace, and it'd be hard to do that unless you can transport yourself. But thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Sherman Alexie.
Got it.
Sherman.
I got it.
Counting Coup is another wonderful book.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wrenching book that deals with this in today's world. And, the Crow Reservation and a wonderful basketball player woman.
I want to say thank you how you made my spirit soar in those gorgeous photographs of Glacier. And then to think, that was only 2 days, 3 days and 4 days ago that we were doing that. And I had myself running through those mountains and wanting to come back there. And then how you made us, challenged us with a sense of how we need to know the indigenous people in this United States in a very in-depth way. And I'm glad there's at least one person in Montana, but I'm sure there's hundreds that do that. But I want to thank you for bringing your stories to us. Thanks so much.